Hi, everybody. My name is Greg Hancock, and along with my salute-worthy friend, Patrick Curran, we make up Quantitude. We're a podcast dedicated to all things quantitative, ranging from the relevant to the completely irrelevant. In today's episode, we talk about the challenges of combining confirmatory factor analysis and multi-level data, and the underappreciated but absolutely critical role that theory plays in choosing the proper model for your constructs. Along the way, we also mention learning in a second language, torn menisci, concert C trumpets, nosy neighbors, forts of equations, artillery commanders, saluting cadets, the huffing closet, hungry, hungry hippos, rock'em sock'em robots, lactose intolerance, Greg's ATM pin, our circle of friend, and configural configurations. We hope you enjoy today's episode. I have this wonderful student right now. Her name is Dayun Lee. She's my TA for an undergrad class that I teach. I don't know if you do this with your TAs. Do you make your TAs attend your classes?
Oh, of course. I figure if I have to be there, they have to be there. I mean, there's no learning element to it. It's just like, why should you get an hour off?
You're damn right. You should at least watch how not to teach this. After class, we are walking back to our building, and we were having this wonderful conversation about regularization and the role that regularization can play in exploratory factor models, other types of latent variable models. And while we're walking, she says, "Dr. Hancock, could you please walk slower?" "Of course. I'm sorry. I didn't realize I was walking so fast." And she said, "Oh, you're not. My walking is fine. And my English is okay, too. But English while walking? I'm not so good at that." I just started laughing, you know, and she thought it was very funny too. And I was imagining myself in a graduate program in another country, in another language, trying to learn something very, very technical. I can't possibly imagine myself doing it. So now we have a thing that whenever we're walking and talking, which we do fairly often, I'll bring the pace way down. And she'll sometimes say, "It's okay on this one. You can walk a little faster on this topic."
My reaction in that situation, if I were her, is I wouldn't slow down in walking. I'd curl up in a ball on the sidewalk. The respect I have for second language speakers and third language speakers.
Totally.
Not just in the different language, but we have this ridiculous jargon and vocabulary and terminology and quantum methods anyway.
Oh, yeah.
Go ahead and translate the difference between homoschedasticity and heteroschedasticity in an asymptotic likelihood ratio test. Like, I'm just going to quit. I'm just going to go home. What I like, though, is, aren't you in a boot right now?
Well, thank you for asking. I was in a boot because of Achilles tendon surgery. Yesterday was my first full day out of the boot.
No way.
I know.
I did not know that. So now you can focus on the knee injury that you sustained because you were in the boot?
That's right. Now my attention is on the torn medial meniscus.
Didn't you tear your knee in the kitchen?
Yes. Shut up. Yes. Yes, I turned because I was in the boot and my meniscus ripped in my other knee.
So, so don't get old.
That's right. I can do a boot. I can do a meniscus. I cannot do a boot and meniscus.
That gets us to, can you walk quickly while speaking in a second language? Can you be in a boot and have an active knee? It's really funny to start thinking about all the things that we can do in isolation, but not together.
Mm.
All right. So a classic one in academia is teach and do research, right? Is why do you think that an internationally recognized researcher can run a class to save their life?
Yeah.
Yes, there are people out in the world who are exceptionally good at doing both, but one is not a given of the other. People can text. People can drive. Can they text and drive? I don't know.
That's right. I'm very good at both separately.
You know what I struggle with? I play trumpet. I play often in a church setting. Church music is written in concert C, but a trumpet is keyed at B flat. It's called a transpositional instrument. So when I play what my C is, a B flat actually comes out of the trumpet on the concert scale. But the problem is our music director will whisper to us in the middle of a service, "I added a song that we're going to play. It's in the hymnal on page 122. Mm-hmm. That is written in concert C. My trumpet is in B flat, so you have to transpose, which means I have to take what's written on the page and I have to raise it a full step to play it.
Yeah.
All right. I'm reasonably good at playing trumpet. I am reasonably good at transposing if I'm at my desk with a cup of coffee. Uh-huh. But in front of 300 people, I am incapable of doing this at the same time. And so you know what I did? I bought a $500 C trumpet, which is keyed in concert. And I never walk into church without both trumpets in my bag.
You just look like an even more accomplished musician, though, right? That you're coming in with your two trumpets. That's very cool.
Yes, it is very cool, except to somebody who's a musician and says, that weak ass can't transpose. But it gets me thinking about Gauss's corpse and Markov's corpse. We haven't dug them up in a while.
By all means, dig them up.
I have to see if Frank is out. Frank is my next door neighbor. Frank is a wonderful, wonderful neighbor. Like, you could not ask for a better neighbor. But he is a bit nosy, and he peeks over the hedge to see kind of what I'm doing. And so I'm really going to have to go out at night and start digging up these corpses. I am currently teaching our second semester grad stat class, which is functionally multiple regression. And just yesterday, I introduced Gauss-Markov assumptions. Uh-huh. Two of the biggies, among several, are we assume our variables are measured without error. And the other one is our residuals are independent. No two residuals are any more or less related than any other two residuals. Mm-hmm. Now, in the spirit of being able to play the trumpet and to be able to transpose music, but maybe not both, we have the entire structural equation model and factor analysis model to deal with measurement error. But instead of taking a mean of 8 items, we could say, well, let's build a multiple indicator latent factor. We can evaluate measurement error. We can model it and remove it and look at what's left over. We're really, really good at that.
Yep.
We're really, really good at dependent residual structure. We have kids within family, students in classrooms, time within person. We have the entire multi-level model. We can disaggregate within group effects, between group effects, get correct standard errors, get correct test statistics, look at within level relations, across level relations. That's the equivalent of playing trumpet reasonably well and transposing reasonably well. But here's the funny story. What if the music director whispers we're playing hymn number 131? We are not so good at having a multiple indicator latent factor in a hierarchically nested setting where we have students in classrooms and we have multiple indicator latent factors and we want to do both.
And there's no concert C trumpet that we can go out and buy to get out of this problem, right?
I'm sure there's a package called Concert C that would allow you to do that.
Concert CFA.
But I'm editing this one, and that's very likely to get cut just because it annoys me. Not inappropriate like usual. So just a few days ago, Greg is working on the next episode editing, and he sent me an audio clip where he told me this story, and then he paused, and he said, that's getting cut, isn't it? And I said, yep.
Is that getting cut?
That's getting cut whole cloth. Okay. Just letting you know.
It was a great story.
And no one will ever hear it.
That's right. I'm still bitter, though.
Talk to us a little bit about why we would want to do this.
Well, there are a couple of different ways of thinking about this as a problem, right? We're interested in assessing a construct, and you and I had an episode on construct validation. So the idea of being able to take a set of items and try to validate the factor structure of those items is something we're absolutely interested in. And sometimes we have data with a nested structure. The data with a nested structure could be a feature of what we're doing, or it could be a bug, right? It could be something we have to try and work around, or there could be a very specific reason why we have data of that structure, a reason that is relevant to what we're doing. So we have to try and wrestle with two issues. And I think we spend a lot of time wrestling with the statistical issues, like, oh, how can we correct for the dependence that we have in these items that is because of the multi-level data structure? I think we spend a lot of time worrying about that and a lot less time thinking about what it actually means on a theoretical level when we're dealing with a factor, right? Because when you have a factor and we have, we'll go with two-level data, like kids within classrooms or patients within therapists, when we're interested in this construct, we have to think about where does the construct really exist? Where does it reside? Is it a characteristic of whoever we're studying at level one? Is it a characteristic of whatever we are studying at level two? And I think that historically we have put nearly zero thought into that part of this process.
Ironically, I think that's the hard part.
Oh, totally.
Because we get all excited about equations and estimators and pseudo maximum likelihood and full information maximum likelihood. And we're in this weirdo field where we can build a fort out of equations and then kind of peek out from between them and say, I'm doing the hard work. That work is hard and that work needs to be done. But I think the really challenging part is, what the hell does it mean? How do we use this in moving our understanding about a complicated world forward in a way that we haven't yet been able to? To puzzle through this, we're going to talk a little bit about methods of estimation, but we're mostly going to shrug and say, this can be done. Mm-hmm. There are different ways of doing it. There are different packages that handle it differently. But we're going to talk a little bit about what are we trying to do. But we're going to say, okay, just assume that we can define these models, we can estimate these models, and then let's think about what the heck are we actually trying to do. I think a good example that we can play both for the factor analytic part and the multi-level part is, a number of years ago, I collaborated with a wonderful colleague, a guy named Pat Sweeney. Mm-hmm. He was a professor at West Point. He was a lieutenant colonel in the Army. He was in the heavy mechanized artillery division, which are tanks. And he was actually not only a tank commander, but he oversaw 900 soldiers in the field.
Talking out the field today. Hi, what's your name?
My name's Bob Fibber.
Bob, what do you do?
I'm in artillery.
Thank you, Bob. Isn't we play anything for you?
Anything! Just play it loud, okay?
When he went back to be a professor at West Point, he had his PhD in social psychology and was interested in leadership. And it was fascinating, absolutely fascinating.
Yeah.
This was all his project. I was a little minion on it who tried to help out where I could. The main thing I liked is when I visited him at West Point, all the cadets would salute him as we walked across campus. And I tried to get my students to salute me. And to this day, they refuse.
You could only get one finger out of him, I bet.
I got one finger salute, which ironically I was used to. Uh-huh. He had a very complicated project, but just for motivation, let's think about two simple parts of it. He was interested in the relation between trust that a soldier had in their leader and influence that that leader had on the soldier's behavior. So it was the relation between trust and influence. There are young women and men who are cadets at West Point, and they are multiple soldiers are nested within squad, and there are maybe 8 or 10 soldiers in a squad, and then there's a squad leader. Mm-hmm. So really classic kind of nesting.
Perfect. Perfect structure.
We have measures on trust that each soldier has in their squad leader. Mm-hmm. And we have perceived influence, the extent to which a soldier believes they're influenced by the squad leader. So let's think about the big thing that we want to do in there, which is the disaggregation of within and between effects.
You got to keep them separated.
That is, when we look at the relation between influence and trust, is it relative trust within a group? So if you're mm-hmm. more trusting than your squad mates, are you amenable to more influence from your leader than your squad mates? Mm-hmm. Or is there a between? On average, what is the trust of the squad as a whole and the influence as a whole? Or as probably it is in reality, is it's some combination of both. There's a within squad relation between trust and influence, and there's a between squad relation. All right, that's classic multi-level, and we're really, really good at doing that. We've been doing this in some way or another for 50 years. All right, but funny story, where does the trust measure come from?
Exactly.
Hancock, you can't see him. First, he's in his huffing closet, and we call it the huffing closet because it's a tiny little closet in his basement where you can't see it right now, of course, but in the background are shelves of paint thinner and I don't know what other toxic things, but he's in the huffing closet, and that whole time I was talking, he's just shaking his head. Where does that measure come from?
Yep.
So we've got, let's say, a 10-item measure of trust. All right, so Hancock, lean back, take a deep breath from all the fumes that are escaping, and talk to us about the measurement of trust.
You're a very handsome man.
Oh, man. Crack the door, Hancock.
Oh, my God.
And don't light a match, for the love of God.
Everything that you were saying about trust and influence really was very classic multi-level kinds of problems until you say, but what do we mean by trust? And what do we mean by influence? And how did we actually get to those particular scores? And that's really the thing that's worth unpacking for this episode, right? Not the multi-level relation between trust and influence, but rather the construct of trust or the construct of influence. This puts us in the realm, or at least potentially in the realm, of what we might call multi-level confirmatory factor analysis, right? We've got this multi-level stuff. We got this measurement-related paradigm of confirmatory factor analysis. And now we have to put them together, or do we have to put them together? That's really the question. What I do know is that when I have multi-level data structures and I just press the CFA button, something might not be right. I have to think through what might not be right. So we have to talk about this both from an estimation standpoint, which there are options, and you kind of alluded to some of those, but then more importantly, the theoretical things, because I think people have a very multi-level knee-jerk reaction to measurement models. Let us just take the standard multi-level architecture and apply it to the CFA. Are we not men? We are Devo. And that's not really such a thoughtful thing to do here.
What we want to do is do this kind of ice cream sandwich. Mm-hmm. We're really good at the confirmatory factor analysis. We're really good at the multi-level model, and we want to squash them together. Now, the interesting thing about this is what we alluded to earlier is people get really excited about the quantitative aspect of doing that. And it is interesting. It is cool. How do we do this analytically? How do we do this statistically? Because this is a non-trivial problem to be addressed. But what Greg and I both also believe, which we alluded to earlier, is that's almost the easy part. Once you separate these within and between factor structures, then we're faced with that inconvenient truth of, well, what does this mean? What do I want? What does this imply? So let's take a very brief trip down memory lane. Let's say that you're working with my buddy. Let's say that your students are saluting you, which I have to admit I really, really liked, and we will puzzle through that later. Let's say that we want to do our usual confirmatory factor analytic approach with nested data. We want to do a multi-level confirmatory factor analysis. Why do we want to do a confirmatory factor analysis? Well, what's the dimensionality of trust? What is the relation between the items and the underlying latent factor? How can we get ideal scores if that's what we're doing? All the usual things. I'm a congenital counter. There are four general ways that we can approach this problem. Mm-hmm. Number one is we ignore it. And that's what we've done for many, many years. Maybe we ignore it entirely. Maybe we do something awful where we randomly select one soldier from each squad and make the data be independent. Those are not good options, either one. What is the problem with ignoring it? It's exactly the same problem of ignoring multi-level structure if we use OLS regression. Our standard errors are wrong. Our mean squared error is wrong. our critical ratios are wrong, our F-tests are wrong, and we're not disaggregating within and between group effects. Other than that, it works super great.
Exactly.
We're just going to dispense with that.
Yep.
Option two is a variant of what McNeish and Stapleton have talked about with multi-level models, which is we take a survey sampling approach and we do what are called cluster-corrected standard errors. We take into account the nesting of the data. We correct standard errors. We correct test statistics. And in many situations, this works really well, particularly when nesting is a nuisance that we want to incorporate and do away with.
Right.
We get correct standard errors and test statistics. We do not disaggregate within group and between group differences. So if that's not a question, then you're fine doing the cluster corrected. If you're interested in if the within squad factor structure of trust is different than the between squad factor structure of trust. Okay, listeners, that's the third time I said that.
Yeah.
And I edited out the other two. That's a really hard sentence to say. The cluster corrected are not going to allow you to do that. That brings us to a corollary with the multi-level model, which is, well, let's separate the within and the between. And there are, of course, multiple ways of doing this. One is what I think is one of the most clever solutions to a problem from this. And Moutain's fingerprints are on this.
Yep.
It is disaggregating the within-group covariance matrix from the between-group covariance matrix. I don't know about you, Hancock, but often I roll my eyes when people name things after themselves. And I'm like, come on. This is sometimes called the MUML approach, M-U-M-L, for Moutain's maximum likelihood.
Right.
This one, I think he should name after himself because it is clever as poop. What he almost literally does, and it's not quite literally, but it's almost literally, he computes the means on the items. He deviates the individual within group around the mean to get what he calls a pooled within covariance matrix. He gets a covariance matrix among the means themselves that is the between. And that would be easy enough to do, but he does this incredibly clever multiple group model where he connects them in a fully balanced case. It is a true maximum likelihood, but if it's unbalanced, so let's say some squads have 3 members, some have 6, some have 9, it's what's called a pseudo maximum likelihood. It is wonderfully clever.
It totally is, right? The idea that if you can convince yourself that what's going on at the group level is independent of what's going on at the individual level, then he just used the multi-group framework here to be able to essentially do a trick to analyze these data both at the within and between level simultaneously. Crazy clever.
That's option 3. Option 4, you have full information maximum likelihood. And what you do is you parameterize it as a single model. You write the likelihood to bring in these between and these within. It is asymptotically superior to all approaches.
Ooh.
Except it is data hungry. Remember Hungry Hungry Hippos?
Of course. I can hear the theme song to the commercial right now.
If you want to win the game, you gotta take good aim and get the most marbles with your hippo.
There are like 4 players. There are these plastic hippos in a circle. You throw a handful of marbles in, and then whoever's hippo eats the most marbles wins. Full information, maximum likelihood, multi-level confirmatory factor analysis is Hungry Hungry Hippos.
Hungry Hungry Hippos is the name of the game, and who's ever hippo gets the most marbles wins.
You have to have large within group size. You have to have a large number of groups. It is hard to estimate stably. It is persnickety. It is unstable. And indeed, MUML is having a little bit of a comeback because people are realizing how persnickety full information maximum likelihood is.
Mm.
And Mummel is a simplification that, again, tends to work pretty well. But those are the four options.
Yeah.
We're going to take as given that if you have a hierarchical structure where you have observations nested within group, there are ways of getting a separation of the within group and the between group factor structure in a multi-level way. Here's the drunken punch in the face that I'm going to do to you in the huffing closet. We solved the problem on separating within and between factor structures. What in heaven's name does it mean?
That's a good question. Let me take a little sniff of paint thinner here.
I was going to say, I'm done here. Is you answer. Go ahead and open that paint can. The one on the right looks really promising. Nope, okay. You're right. Not the other my right. Okay, there we go. All right, proceed.
The question really is about the construct itself. It's funny when you were using Hungry Hungry Hippo and Fimmel, or the equivalent of Fimmel, as tying those together, as if Hungry Hungry Hippo is this finely tuned instrument. You beat the crap out of that game. That's what you did.
But that was the cornerstone of all of our games, right? As everything was, you just wailed away on something
until
the timer goes up.
That's right. Like Rock'em Sock'em Robots. Did you have Rock'em Sock'em Robots?
The world's only boxing robots. Get the Rock'em Sock'em Robots by Mark.
The first question I think we need to ask ourselves, and it might not even be one that you all have thought of out there, but that is, what is the level that you're interested in for a construct? It sounds like a weird question, right? Because if I say something like motivation, well, we were interested in how motivated the students are. But what if I say something like teacher quality? And I have students in classrooms provide ratings of their teachers. What level is teacher quality at? Is teacher quality at the level of the student, or is teacher quality at the level of the teacher or of the classroom? And I hope that there's a moment where you're going, wait a minute. There's an example that we used in one of our papers. And I say one of our papers. I was a third author on a paper with Laura Stapleton and Jisung Yang. And we had sort of spitballed the ideas behind this paper. But I was in no way a thought leader on anything. And they deserve all the credit on this.
That was like the Bauer and Curran papers on mixture modeling that have thousands of citations. And uh-huh. I was fifth author, but there was only two of us. And so you couldn't have Bauer blank, 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 and Curran.
Just put some extra commas in between. In a paper that we did around 2016 or so that came out in Journal of Educational and Behavioral Statistics, one example that we used was an instrument that was assessing lactose intolerance. And it sounds like a very funny construct, but then I can't believe I'm saying this. The nice thing about lactose intolerance is that it's very clearly a property of the individual, right? We don't think of lactose intolerance as a property of a classroom. We don't think of it as a property of a school. So that is clearly an individual level construct. On the other hand, if we think of something like community violence, and we have a number of members of several communities provide ratings of community violence, is community violence a property of the individual, or is community violence a property of the community itself? So a first question out of the gate is, where is your construct, right? Is your construct at level one or level two? And if the construct we're interested in is a level one or individual level construct, kid motivation, for example, and if you don't care about the clusters, and here's what I mean by that. If you consider all of the data that you have to be from some larger population
are we back on the lactose intolerance?
It smells in here. It's nice. It's nice in here. What were we talking about?
You were just about to tell us your ATM pin.
It's your birthday, Patrick.
On topic, Hancock. Come on.
Anyway, if we're interested in the population from which all of these observations came, and we view the grouping of those observations really as an annoyance, then Patrick said it right off the bat. He said, then you just do a regular old CFA, but you use cluster corrections, and all is good. You don't even need to find your way into the whole multi-level modeling framework. A wrinkle to that, though, is if someone is actually interested in using this instrument within clusters, right? Or interested in generalizing within the observations that are specifically nested within a cluster. If someone was interested in making comparisons on the lack, I can't even say it with a straight face. If the principal of Our Lady of Perpetual Flatulence wants to make... If the principal wants to make comparisons on lactose intolerance of individuals within a given school, then our focus really is on the behavior that's operating inside the school. When you have something like that going on, you actually have a couple of options from a modeling standpoint. One is a very simple classical kind of option, and that is essentially mean centering your data or cluster mean centering your data so that you get the mean differences out. And then what you're doing really is the equivalent of doing your confirmatory factor model on a pooled covariance matrix, where you've taken the variances and covariances from all of the different clusters and then wound up pooling them together. Another option that's a little bit fancier is to go into the multi-level framework. But in that multi-level framework, because your interest is at the within level, right? That level one, the individuals within the clusters, we can have a model with both a within and between side, but the within and the between sides do not need to be the same. And that's a really important point because I think the knee-jerk reaction for multi-level modelers is to have this parallel structure operating at both levels. But in this particular case, if you want to work within the multi-level framework, then you can impose your confirmatory factor model on the within side. And then on the between side, all you really need to do is have a saturated model. And what I mean by saturated model is not a factor model. You just need to have variances and covariances of all the between versions of the variables that you have, saturating them out, allowing them to covary. So you are compensating for what's going on at the between level, but there's no need to model it as a factor.
When you think about fitting a structure within level one in the usual way conceptually that we would do, and then saturating level two, which is I'm just going to throw open the barn doors, let all the horses out, and everything relates with everything else.
Exactly.
What that does is to say, whoa, wait a minute. If I've got correlations among my indicators at level two, well, I got a hankering to put a factor structure on that. And then that's a double whammy because one, can we model those correlations as a function of an underlying latent factor? And two, well, what on earth is the relation between the level one structure and the level two structure? Because those could be the same, those could be different.
And that takes us into the idea of moving toward the measurement modeling of what's going on at level one, also at level two. If we were interested in having this shadow model at the between level that gives us information about the construct itself, then we absolutely can have the factor model that we're modeling at level one also appear at level two. This kind of context is sometimes referred to as a configural cluster construct, or Marsh called it a contextual cluster construct. You want that factor to allow you to model what's going on across the clusters, across level two. So in essence, it's characterizing what's going on at that mean of the cluster level. And in order for it to do that, we need to impose invariance on the loadings that we have on the within side and the between side, which is what Zeifer and colleagues had called cross-level measurement invariance. So when we do that, we get some interesting additional information out. We will get out variability of whatever that characteristic is. So if you were modeling trust of cadets within squads, when we have that factor structure on the squad side, we still think of it as an individual level construct, a cadet level construct. But if we want to know about the averages of those across the clusters that we have, that model where we freeze the measurement to be equal across both within and between allows us to get some characteristics of that construct as it varies across the clusters, in this case, across the squads.
And this is where I myself start to get confused in the literature because different authors use different meanings of the word invariance.
Mm.
Some say there's invariance across level if it's the same configuration.
Mm-hmm.
If you have one factor at level one, you have one in level two. If you have two in level one, you have two in level two. Other other authors have used the more traditional Meredith definition, which is the factor loadings themselves are equal across level one and level two. There has yet to be a shared terminology that everyone uses in the same way.
I think it's made somewhat more confusing by the term configural cluster level construct, because the word configural has very specific meaning in that Meredith framework. And I think it's being used a little bit differently within this multi-level confirmatory framework.
Just as a reminder, Bill Meredith had a paper in Psychometrica in 93, I think it was, that laid out how to do measurement invariance and confirmatory factor models, assuming independence. And this is where configural, weak, strong, strict invariance came from. And people are drawing those concepts and applying them here, which they absolutely do apply. Mm-hmm. But where some of the confusion comes in is when you break it into the two levels, there's not a one-to-one correspondence.
There is some really nice literature on the invariance issue across the between and within. Suzanne Jaak at University of Amsterdam has written a number of things that talk about it, not just from a definitional standpoint where you're trying to get the between side to be reflective of what's going on down on the within side, but also the tremendous benefits of those loading constraints just at getting the damn model to run, right? If you think about how many units you have at level two versus how many units you have at level one, we're talking a good game here, but sometimes these models are actually kind of difficult to get to run, right?
Playing Hungry, Hungry Hippos!
Hey!
Hungry, Hungry Hippos!
And there's a mixture modeling analogy here. To get the things to stably estimate, you have to put in a lot of constraints that may or may not hold in the population, but you're imposing just to get a solution.
Yeah.
And pretty rapidly, the convergence tail is wagging the conceptual dog. And that's an issue that we really need to pay attention to.
That's right. And I would say theory really needs to be your guide here in what's operating, right? I'm never an advocate of constraining things to get the thing to run because I don't know what the damn thing is anymore if I'm imposing constraints that I don't believe in.
But it converged, you heretic. It converged.
So the model that we're talking about, just as a little side note, is one that gives you a measure of variability in essentially the mean levels of the construct across the different clusters that you have, across the different level two units. In the work that Laura Stapleton and Jisung Yang did, where they kindly included me as an author.
Did you like check the references?
I caught a typo. But we actually offered an augmentation of that model in the paper where the assumption in that model is the means might differ across clusters of the construct you're interested in. But the point we wanted to make is that, sometimes the variability in those clusters differs as well. You don't expect the different clusters necessarily to be equally dispersed within them. And so we offered a little parameterization so that you could have a random coefficient that represents differences in variability within the different clusters as well. But again, the constructs that we have just been talking about have all been individual level constructs. But then the reasonable question is, what do you do when you have a construct that you literally think of as being at level two? You know, I gave you the example of teacher quality. I have all these students providing ratings of teacher quality, but presumably teacher quality is a characteristic at that classroom level or at the teacher level. And if all of the students had equal insight into the quality of teaching, those students would essentially be interchangeable. They would just be all trying to tell me the same thing about the quality of that teacher. Or if I'm interested in a construct of school violence and I ask the students to provide information about school violence, yes, it is their perceptions. But if we think of the level of violence in a school as a characteristic of the school, then the students are all trying to provide us information about that construct that is at level two. And so these are sometimes called shared constructs. That was something that a wonderful guy, Paul Bleasey, used that term shared construct way back in 2000. And I think Marsh and colleagues referred to it as a climate construct. But the cool thing about this is that we can actually invoke the same type of model that we had where we didn't care about the between level. We just wanted to get her done, right? And we allowed everything to covariate. we can do something similar here in a shared construct where we can model the factor at that between level or that level two, and then we can have a saturated structure down on the within side, sort of flipping what we had, and we could get at this thing called a shared construct. And that is terrific for constructs that we really believe are at level two, and we essentially view what's going on down on the within side or the individual level as just noise in the system.
I love the symmetry of it, because you can have a factor at level one and you saturate level two. You can have a factor at level two and saturate level one. Help me out. I assume you can do both.
This is one of the reasons you and I get along. We like ordered lists. We like counting things. We like symmetry.
And we have no other friends. It's a degree of freedom problem, really.
That's right. We have all the same friend. It is possible that you have things going on both at the individual level and at the group level. Imagine that we have an individual level construct and we are interested in having that reflected in the between side as well. We might have something like feelings of support that students have in school. And feelings of support are an individual level characteristic. So I want a construct that models feelings of support, but I would also like to accommodate differences in school average levels of feelings of support. And so I have this structure over on the between side or the school side that mirrors and has measurement constraints to be invariant with what's down there on the within side. So I have that configural structure that is capturing feelings of support, but I also am interested in modeling, let's say, I'll call it positive school culture, all right? And positive school culture is not an individual level thing. Positive school culture is something at the school level or level two. So I can have a model that accommodates the configural construct that was down at the individual level that we would like to have reflected at the cluster level, and an additional factor, a shared factor that might be operating on top. And the important thing here is we need to have that configural construct at the cluster level in place, because if we didn't have that and we just said, hey, we got an individual level factor down here and we got a shared factor up here, the shared factor wouldn't know how to be above and beyond that factor that was really operating at the individual level. So having the configural configuration, yes, I said that.
You know what I hate about the unclimbable mountain of unclimbableness? Just to get there, you have to cross the uncrossable river of uncrossableness.
Who named all these things?
That guy over there, the redundant scribe of redundantness.
Hi there, greetings.
Having the configural configuration with that mirror image of the individual level construct at the between or cluster level is really important so you can have that shared thing on top of it. But I'll tell you what, all of these things really just indicate that there is a whole heck of a lot more thinking to do when someone lays a factor on the table and they have a multi-level data structure, a whole lot more thinking than just pressing the multi-level button.
If you're doing a multi-level model in the traditional way, and you can wax poetic about the within relation between trust and influence, the between relation between trust and influence, within level interactions, between level interactions, just pick one of those rectangles, whether it be trust, whether it be influence, whether it be anything else in your model, and then lean back and think about, can I apply the same disaggregation question to the very nature of the structure of the measurement of that construct? Picture in your mind's eye, trust is not a rectangle, but it's a multiple indicator latent factor. And even if you don't have the data available to evaluate it, you need to do a thought experiment about what do I believe about the structure of this construct within and between clusters.
Totally.
This is a fundamental question that rarely, if ever, do we ask.
For people who are interested in construct validation and have data that are either annoyingly multi-level or deliberately multi-level, I would highly recommend that you dig into the work of some of the people that we have mentioned.
We'll put a whole list on the show notes.
Great.
In the spirit of fertile ground for future research, there is a ton of interesting stuff to do here. And so if this is something that you find interesting, and it is a bit of an ice cream sandwich, maybe you know something about factor analysis, maybe you know something about multi-level modeling and you want to put them together, there's so much more that we need to learn about sample size, effect size, power, model evaluation. How do you adjudicate among a one factor, a two factor, a quality constraints? Because the program gives you a chi-square and a TLI and a CFI and an RMSEA, but it's not super clear those mean the same things that they do in the independent situation.
Yeah.
And then there's a whole bunch on scoring. So I had a wonderful graduate student, Chris Strauss, who is now at Vanderbilt. Their entire dissertation was looking at different scoring methods for these different kinds of approaches. And that work can be extended in different ways as well. This is a fertile ground for really cool things.
Absolutely.
Even if you don't do this in your own analysis, you really do need to squint your eyes and cock your head and look at your variables and say to yourself, do I believe this mean score of the items is adequately representing the construct both within and between level? Because I got to tell you, if you blow that in the ways that Greg has described the different kinds of structures that can exist, that's a massive threat to internal validity.
Yep.
You're going to write an entire discussion section about the relation between trust and influence, and you may have it completely wrong because you blew the factor structure in the disaggregation of those across the two levels.
Lots of things to think about, both statistically and theoretically, and we hope folks out there seize the opportunity.
Now, I have a whole bunch more notes of things that I wanted to say, but I can't record and look at my notes at the same time, and so I'm done.
All right, I've got some deep breathing to do. I'll see ya.
Get out! Bye-bye, everybody. Thank you so much for listening. You can subscribe to Quantitude on Apple, Spotify, Google, or a bunch of really sketchy platforms that keep offering to sell us 5-star rankings at a very reasonable cost. And please leave us a review. You can also follow us on Twitter X. We are at Quantitude Pod. And check out our webpage at quantitudepod.org for searchable playlists, show notes, a syllabus that organizes episodes under class topics, and other cool stuff. Finally, buy a graduation gift for someone special that is something other than a copy of Oh, the Places You'll Go, with awesome Quantitude-themed merch at redbubble.com, where all proceeds from non-bootleg authorized products go to donors choose to support low-income schools. You have been listening to Quantitude, a podcast so annoying you wish you could do multiple other things at the same time. Inspired by Hungry Hungry Hippo, Quantitude has been brought to you by other classic childhood games, but with a contemporary academic twist. By Monopoly, try to become the faculty member who ruthlessly builds the biggest empire of graduate and undergraduate assistants at the lowest possible cost with no remorse about how your decisions benefit anyone but yourself. By Pictionary, see who's fastest at deciphering the completely illegible statistical formulas the professor writes on the board before they unexpectedly erase them and move on to the next topic with absolutely no memory of what they wrote just moments before. By Dungeons & Dragons, where the dungeon is a windowless asbestos-ensconced interior office and the dragons are aloof senior faculty whose grants buy them out of so many classes, you're stuck with 3 new preps in your first year. You get to cancel 1 lecture for a wellness day if you roll a nat 20. And finally, by Clue, the wildly popular game of whodunit where you and your lab try to figure out the identity of the reviewer who murdered your manuscript in cold blood. Just as a hint, look at the author of the set of essential papers the reviewer claimed you neglected to cite. This is most definitely not NPR.